tall, reed-thin, good-looking man with loads of experience in the field, but I had the distinct impression he would have been more comfortable on a tennis court than in the middle of a dangerous mess like this one. "Here's what we have so far from surveillance," Ainsley told the group. "One of HRT's snipers picked up a couple of images, and then we shot some more. We think it's all pretty good news. Take a look for yourselves." The visual images had been downloaded to a laptop, and Ainsley played them for us. The video stream was a series of wide and tight shots showing half a dozen windows on the east side of the building. "We were concerned that these windows haven't been covered up," Ainsley pointed out. "These little shits are supposed to be smart and careful, right? Anyway, we've identified 5 males and 2 females inside the building. I'm sorry to say that Colonel Schaefer hasn't shown up on any of the surveillance tapes. Not so far, anyway. We don't have anything on him leaving the building either, just going inside. We're using thermal imaging to see if we might have missed him or any others." The Washington PD hadn't been able to afford thermal, but I'd seen it work since coming to the Bureau. It picked up heat variances, hotspots, which allowed surveillance to see right through walls. Ainsley pointed to the close-up shot that was on the laptop screen now. "Here's where it gets interesting," he said, and froze a shot showing 2 men seated at a small table in the kitchen. "On the left is Kareem Al-Lilius. He's number 14 on Homeland Security's hit list. He's definitely Al-Qaeda. Suspected of involvement in the 98 bombings of our embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi. We don't know when he arrived or why, but he sure as hell is here now. The man beside Al-Lilius, Ahmed El-Masri, is big number 8 on the list. He's hot. He's also an engineer. Neither of these bastards was on earlier surveillance tapes. Both must have just snuck into town. For what reason? Under ordinary circumstances, we'd be in that kitchen with them right now, making mint tea for everybody, getting ready for a nice long chat. They have these same pictures downtown and in Washington right now. We ought to hear something soon, one way or the other." Ainsley looked around the room and finally cracked a smile. "For the record, I recommended that we go in, make some tea, have that chat." The small room broke into loud applause. For a brief moment there, it was almost fun. Chapter 48. Some of the more devil-may-care, gung-ho guys from the hostage rescue team, which is just about all of them, call this kind of dangerous operation 5 minutes of panic and thrill. Their panic, our thrill. The very personal thrill for me would be bringing down Jeffrey Schaefer. HRT and SWAT desperately wanted to go into the building and were on the ready. 2 dozen heavily armed, state-of-the-art warriors were strutting around the wooden floor of the meatpacking plant. They were pumped up and supremely confident in their ability to do the job right and very quickly. Watching them, it was hard not to be, and even harder not to ask to be included in the raid. The real problem was that if they succeeded, we all might lose. We had been warned and been given dramatic lessons about what would happen if we disregarded the orders handed down by the Wolf. And yet, the men under our surveillance might be his attack team in New York. So what did we do? I knew every detail about the job. Taking down the building would involve full team deployment of the group, including both HRT and NYPD SWAT. There were 6 assault teams and 6 sniper teams, which HRT believed was too many. They didn't want help from SWAT. The HRT sniper teams were called X-Ray, Whiskey, Yankee, and Zulu. Each included 7 members. 1 FBI team was assigned to each side of the building. SWAT would assist on the front and rear only. The interesting thing for me was the certainty that HRT was the superior assault team, the opposite of what I'd felt when I was with the DC police. The HRT snipers were disguised in urban hide kits, individualized bunches of black muslin, rope, dark PVC tubing, and the like. Each sniper had a specific target, and every window and door in the building was covered. The question remained, were we going in? And was Schaefer still there? Was the weasel in that building right now? At 2:30 in the morning, I joined a two-man sniper team in the brownstone directly across the street from the targeted one. This was starting to get very intense and very hairy. The snipers were holed up inside a 10-by-10 room. They had made a tent out of black muslin, set back about 3 feet from the window. The window itself was kept closed, and I was given an explanation by one of them. If we get the signal to go, we'll use a lead pipe to knock out the window pane. Seems kind of crude, but nobody's come up with a better option. There wasn't too much small talk in the cramped, hot room, but for the next half hour, I got to watch the targeted building through a sniper scope from a backup rifle. My heart was starting to race pretty good now. I was searching for Schaefer in the scope. What if I saw him? How could I stay up there? The seconds were ticking away, and I could just about measure them with my own heartbeats. The assault team was the eyes and ears for command, and all we could do was wait for our official orders to come down. Go. No go. I finally broke the silence in the small room. I'm going down on the street. I need to be down there for this. Chapter 49. This was more like it. I set up with an HRT assault team just around the corner from the terrorist hideout. Technically, I wasn't supposed to be there. So officially, I wasn't. But I'd called Ned Mahoney, and he smoothed the way for me. 3 o'clock in the a.m. The minutes passed very slowly, without more news or clarification from command in New York or FBI headquarters in the Hoover Building in Washington. What were they thinking? How could anybody make an impossible decision like this one? Go? No go? Obey the wolf? Disobey and take the consequences? 3:30 came and went. Then 4 o'clock. Still no word from the higher-ups back at headquarters. I got strapped up in a black flight suit with full armor and was given an MP5. The HRT guys all knew about Schaefer and my personal stake in this. The senior agent in charge sat down beside me on the ground. You okay? Everything all right? I was DC homicide. I've gone into a lot of places, a lot of hot spots. I know you have. If Schaefer's in there, we'll get him. Maybe you'll get him. Yeah. Maybe I'll blow that creep away after all, I thought. And then, amazingly, we got the order to go. Green light. 5 minutes of panic and thrill. First thing, I heard the snipers breaking windows across the street. Then we were running toward the hideout building. Everybody was strapped up for war, all in black flight suits and armed to the teeth. 2 8-passenger Bell helicopters suddenly appeared and veered in toward the roof of the brick building. They hovered and assault specialists began to fast rope down. One team of 4 was climbing up the side of the building, an amazing sight in itself. Another of HRT's go-to-war slogans flashed through my head. Speed, suspense, and violence of action. It was happening just like that. I heard explosive entry charges blasting out doors, 3 or 4 different blasts within seconds. There would be no negotiating as part of this assault. We were in. This was good. I was in. Gunshots echoed through the dark halls of the building. Then machine gun bursts came from somewhere above me. I made it up to the second floor. A male with wild, bushy hair came out of a doorway. He had a rifle. Hands in the air, I yelled at him. In the air, high. He understood English. He put his hands up and let the rifle drop. Where's Colonel Schaefer? Where's Schaefer? I screamed at him. The man just shook his head back and forth, looking dazed and confused. I left the prisoner with a couple of HRT guys, then hurried upstairs to the third floor. I wanted the weasel so badly now. Was he in there somewhere? A waif of a woman in black suddenly ran across a large living room area at the head of the stairs. "Stop!" I bellowed at her. "You, stop!" But she didn't. She went right out an open window in the living room. I heard her scream, then nothing after that. Sickening to watch. And finally I heard, "Secure! The building is secure! All floors secure!" But nothing about Jeffrey Schaefer. Nothing about the weasel.
Chapter 50.
The HRT and NYPD SWAT teams were swarming around the building. All the doors had been blown off their hinges and several windows were shattered. So much for knock and announce protocol. But the plan seemed to have worked well from what I could see so far. Except for finding Schaefer. Where was that son of a bitch? I'd missed him like this a couple of times before. The woman who'd gone out the top floor window was dead, which is what happens when you plunge head first 3 stories down onto a sidewalk. I congratulated a few HRT guys as I made my way through the top floor. They did the same for me. I met Michael Ainsley on the stairs. "Washington wants you involved with the interrogations," he told me, not seeming too pleased. "There are 6 of them. How do you want to handle it?" "Schaefer?" I asked Ainsley. "Anything on him?" "They say he isn't here. We don't know for sure. We're still looking for him." I couldn't help feeling a letdown about the weasel, but I sucked it up. I walked inside a workspace that had been turned into a quasi-apartment. Sleeping bags and a few stained mattresses were strewn across the bare wooden floor. 5 males and a woman sat together handcuffed like prisoners of war, which I suppose they were. I stared at them without saying a word at first. Then I pointed to the youngest-looking male. Small, thin, wire-rimmed glasses, scruffy beard, of course. "Him," I said, and started to walk out of the room. "I want that one. Bring him now." After the young male was taken from the main living area to a smaller adjoining bedroom, I looked around the main room again. I pointed to another youngish male with long, curly black hair and a full beard. "That one," I said, and he was also escorted out. No explanation. Next, I was introduced to an FBI interpreter, a man named Waseed, who spoke Arabic, Farsi, Pashto. We entered the bedroom next door together. "He's probably Saudi, possibly all of them are," the interpreter told me on the way in. Wherever he was from, the small, thin young man seemed extremely nervous. Sometimes Islamic terrorists are more comfortable with the idea of dying than with being captured and questioned by the devil. That was my leverage here. I was the devil. I encouraged the translator to engage the terrorist suspect in small talk about his hometown and then his difficult transition to life in New York, the devil's den. I asked that he slip in that I was a fairly good man and one of the few FBI agents who wasn't inherently evil. Tell him I read the Quran. Beautiful book. In the meantime, I sat and tried to model the terrorist's behavior, to mimic it, without being too obvious. He sat forward in his chair, so did I. If I could become the first American he would learn to trust, even a little, he might let something slip. It didn't work too well at first, but he did answer a few questions about his city of origin. He maintained that he came to America on a student visa, but I knew he didn't have a passport. He also didn't know the location of any universities in New York, not even NYU. Finally, I got up and stomped angrily out of the room. I went to see the second suspect and repeated the same process with him. Then I returned to the skinny youth. I carried in a stack of reports and threw them on the floor. There was a loud whack, and he actually jumped. "Tell him he lied to me," I yelled at the translator. "Tell him I trusted him. Tell him the FBI and CIA aren't filled with fools, whatever he's been told in his country. Just keep talking to him. Yelling is even better. Don't let him talk until he has something to tell us. Then yell over whatever he has to say. Tell him he's going to die, and then we'll track down his entire family in Saudi Arabia. For the next couple of hours, I kept going back and forth between the two rooms. My years as a therapist made me fairly good at reading people, especially in a disturbed state. I picked out a third terrorist, the remaining woman, and added her to the mix. CIA officers were questioning the subjects every time I left a room. No torture, but it was a constant barrage. In the FBI training sessions at Quantico, they talk about their principles of interrogation as the RPMs, rationalization, projection, and minimization. I rationalized like crazy. You're a good person, Ahmed. Your beliefs are true ones. I wish I had your strong faith. I projected blame. It isn't your fault. You're just a young guy. The United States government can be evil at times. Sometimes I think we need to be punished myself. I minimized consequences. So far, you've committed no actual crimes here in America. Our weak laws and judicial system can protect you. And I got down to business. Tell me about the Englishman. We know that his name is Jeffrey Schaefer. He's called the Weasel. He was here yesterday. We have videotapes, photographs, audio tapes. We know he was here. Where is he now? He's the one we really want. I kept at it, repeating my pitch again and again. What did the Englishman want you to do? He's the guilty one, not you or your friends. We already know this. Just fill in a few blanks for us. You'll be able to go home. Then I repeated the same questions about the wolf. Nothing worked with any of the terrorists, though, not even the young ones. They were tough, more disciplined and more experienced than they looked, smart and clearly very motivated. Why not? They believed in something. Maybe there's something to be learned from that, too. Chapter 51. The next terrorist I chose was older, ruddily good-looking, with a thick mustache and white, nearly perfect teeth. He spoke English and told me with some pride that he had studied at Berkeley and Oxford.
Biochemistry and electrical engineering. Does that surprise you?
His name was Ahmed El Masri, and he was number 8 on Homeland Security's hit list. He was very willing to talk about Jeffrey Schaefer.
Yes, the Englishman came here. You are right about this, of course. Video and audio tapes don't usually lie. He claimed to have something important he wanted to talk to us about.
And did he? El Masri frowned deeply.
No, not really. We thought he might be one of your agents.
So why did he come here? I asked. Why did you consent to see him? El Masri shrugged off my question.
Curiosity. He said that he had access to tactical nuclear explosive devices.
I winced, and my heart started to beat a whole lot faster. Nuclear devices in the metropolitan New York area? Did he have the weapons? I asked.
We agreed to talk with him. We believed he meant suitcase nuclear bombs. Suitcase nukes. Difficult to obtain, but not impossible. As you may know, the Soviet Union built them during the Cold War. No one knows how many or what happened to them. The Russian mafia has tried to sell them in recent years, or so it's rumored. I wouldn't actually know. I came here to be a professor, you see, to look for employment.
A shudder passed through me. Unlike conventional warheads, suitcase nukes were designed to go off at ground level. They were about the size of a large valise and could easily be operated by an infantryman. They could also be concealed just about anywhere, even carried on foot around New York, Washington, London, Frankfurt. So, did he have access to suitcase nukes? I asked El Masri. He shrugged.
We are just students and teachers. In truth, why should we care about nuclear weapons?
I thought that I understood what he was doing now, bargaining for himself and his people. "Why did one of your students kill herself diving from a window?" I asked. El Masri's eyes narrowed in pain.
"She was afraid all the time she was in New York. She was an orphan, her parents killed in an unjust war by Americans."
I nodded slowly as if I understood and sympathized with what he was telling me. "All right. You haven't committed any crimes here. We've been watching you for weeks. But did Colonel Schaefer have access to nuclear weapons?" I asked again. "That's the question I need answered. It's important for you and for your people. Are you following me?"
"I believe so. Are you suggesting that we would be deported if we cooperate? Sent home, since we've committed no actual crimes?"
El Masri asked. He was trying to pin down the deal. I came right back at him. "Some of you have committed serious crimes in the past, murders. The others will be questioned and then they will be sent home." He nodded.
"All right then. I did not get the impression that Mr. Schaefer had tactical nuclear weapons in his possession. You say that you've been watching us. Maybe he knew that also. Does that make sense to you? That you were set up? I don't pretend to understand this myself, but these are thoughts that pass through my mind as I sit and talk to you."
Unfortunately, what he was telling me made sense. I was afraid that might be what had happened. A trap, a test. It was the wolf's pattern so far. "How did Schaefer get out of here without our seeing him leave?" I asked.
"The basement in the building connects to a building to the south. Colonel Schaefer knew that. He seemed to know a lot about us."
It was 9 a.m. by the time I left the building. I felt exhausted, as though I could lie down and sleep in an alleyway. The suspects would be transported soon, and the whole area was still shut down, even the Holland Tunnel, because of our fear that it might be a primary target, that it might suddenly be blown up. Had everything been a test? A trap? Chapter 52. The day's weirdness wasn't over. A crowd had gathered outside the building, and as I pushed away out toward my ride, someone called to me. "Dr. Cross!" "Dr. Cross? Who was calling me?" A kid in a tan and crimson windbreaker waved so that I'd see him. "Dr. Cross, over here! Dr. Alex Cross! I need to talk to you, man!" I walked over to the young man, who was probably in his late teens. I stopped and leaned in close to him. "How do you know my name?" I asked. He shook his head and backed up a step. "You were warned, man," he said. "You were warned by the wolf." As soon as the words were out of his mouth, I was all over him, grabbing at his hair, his jacket. I took him down on the ground in a headlock. I fell on top of him with all my weight. Red-faced, his lean body torquing powerfully, he started screaming at me. "Hey, hey, I was paid to give you a message. Get the fuck off me. Guy gave me $100. I'm just a messenger, man. English guy told me you were Dr. Alex Cross." The youth, the messenger, looked into my eyes. "You don't seem like no doctor to me." Chapter 53.
The wolf was in New York. He couldn't miss the big deadline, not for all the money in the world. This was going to be too good, too delicious not to savor. The negotiations were really heating up now. The U.S. president, the British prime minister, the German chancellor. Of course, none of them wanted to make a deal, to be exposed for the incredible weaklings they were. One couldn't deal with terrorists, could one? What kind of precedent would it set? They needed even more pressure, more stress, more convincing before they collapsed. Hell, he could do that. He would be only too happy to oblige, to torture these fools. The whole thing was so predictable, to him, anyway. He went for a long walk on the east side of Manhattan, a constitutional. He was feeling at the top of his game. How could the governments of the world compete with him? He had every advantage. No politics, no media pundits, bureaucracies, laws, or ethics to get in his way. Who could beat that? He returned to one of several apartments he owned around the world, this one a stunning penthouse overlooking the East River, and made a phone call. Lightly squeezing his black rubber ball, he spoke to a senior agent from the New York FBI office, one of their top people, a woman. The agent told him everything the Bureau knew so far and what they were doing to find him, which was basically nothing of consequence. They had a far better chance of suddenly finding Bin Laden than of finding him. The wolf yelled into the telephone receiver.
I'm supposed to pay you for this shit? For telling me what I already know? I should kill you instead.
But then the Russian laughed.
Just a nasty joke, my friend. You bring me good news, and I have news for you. There is going to be an incident in New York very soon. Stay away from the bridges. Bridges are very dangerous places. I know this from past experience.
Chapter 54.
Bill Capistran was the man with a plan, and also a very bad and dangerous attitude. Serious anger management problems, to put it mildly. But soon, he'd also be the man with $250 large in his bank account in the Caymans. All he had to do was his particular job, and what he had to do wasn't going to be that hard. I can do this. No problemo. Capistran was 29 years old, slim and sinewy, originally from Raleigh, North Carolina. He had played lacrosse for a year at North Carolina State, then left for the Marines. After a 3-year stint, he'd been recruited to do merc work for a company out of Washington. Then, 2 weeks ago, he'd been approached by a guy he knew from D.C., Jeffrey Schaefer, and he'd agreed to do the biggest job of his career, $250,000's worth. He was on the job now. At 7 in the morning, he drove a black Ford van east across 57th Street in Manhattan, then turned north at First Avenue. Finally, he parked near the 59th Street Bridge, also called the Queensboro. He and two men in white painter's overalls climbed out of the van, then gathered up equipment from the back. Not paint and drop cloths and aluminum ladders. Explosives. A combination of C4 and nitrate to be packed into the bridge's lowest trusses at a strategic point near the Manhattan side of the East River. Capistran knew the Queensboro inside and out by now. He stared up at the sturdy 95-year-old bridge, and what he saw was an open, flexible structure, a cantilever truss design, the only one of the 4 East River bridges that wasn't a suspension bridge, which meant that it required a special kind of bomb, one that he just happened to have in the back of the van. This is something else, Capistran couldn't help thinking as he and his compadres hauled their gear toward the bridge. New York City, the East Side, all these fancy-ass big business dicks, these blonde princesses walking around as though the world was theirs for the taking. Nerves aside, he was almost enjoying himself now, and he found himself whistling a song that struck him as pretty funny. The 59th Street Bridge Song, Feelin' Groovy, by Simon and Garfunkel, whom he considered to be typical New York City assholes, too. Both of them, Curly and the Midget. For the past couple of days, Capistran had been working into the wee hours with a couple of sympathetic engineering students at Stony Brook University out on Long Island. One whiz kid was from Iran, the other from Afghanistan. They got a kick and a half out of the irony, too. New York-trained college students helping to blow up New York. Land of the fucking free, right? They called their team the Manhattan Project. Another insider joke. At first, they had considered an ANFO, a type of bomb that would blow a crater in a road for sure, but was unlikely to topple a large bridge, like the Queensboro. The college whizzes told Capistran that he could see what an ANFO would accomplish just by setting off a firecracker on a city street, or imagining it. The explosion would be characterized by coward forces which always seek the path of least resistance. In other words, the bomb would make a nasty little burn on the road, but the real destructive power would escape up and sideways into the air. Not good enough for today. Too benign. Not even close to what was needed. Then the clever-as-hell college students came upon a much better way to blow up the bridge. They instructed Capistran on how and where to attach several small charges at different points in the foundation. This was similar to the way demolition companies toppled old buildings, and it would work like a charm. Since he had absolutely no interest in being caught, Capistran had considered sending divers into the East River to set the charges on the supports. He had approached the bridge several times himself, and to his surprise, he found security to be virtually non-existent. That's exactly the way it was early that morning. He and his two associates walked out on the lower supports of the 59th Street Bridge, and nobody said boo to them. From a distance, the ornate silver-painted ironwork and finials had made the old bridge look rather delicate. Up close, the real power of the structure was revealed. The massive trusses, rivets as large as a man's kneecaps. This sounded crazy, but it would work. His piece would work. Sometimes he wondered how he'd gotten so sour on everything, so bitter and full of rage. Hell, years ago in the Marines, he'd been part of the rescue team that had extracted downed pilots like Scott O'Grady in Bosnia. Well, he wasn't a war hero anymore. He was just another capitalist working in the system, right? And that was a lot truer statement than most people could let themselves believe. As he continued to walk out on the support structure, Capistran couldn't help humming, then singing the words to Curly and the Midgets' 59th Street Bridge Song.
Chapter 55. The strangest, most puzzling thing happened next. The deadline passed, and nothing happened. There was no message from the wolf, no immediate attacks, nothing. Silence. It was eerie, but also incredibly scary. The wolf was the only one who knew what was going on now. Or maybe the wolf, the president, and a few other world leaders. Rumor had it that the president, vice president, and the cabinet had already been moved out of Washington. This thing wouldn't stop, would it? The news stories certainly wouldn't. The Post, the New York Times, USA Today, CNN, the networks, they had all gotten hold of some version of the threats against major cities. No one knew which cities or who was doing the threatening, but after years of yellow and orange alerts from Homeland Security, no one seemed to take the threats and rumors too seriously. The uncertainty, the war of nerves, had to be part of the wolf's plan, too. I was in Washington for the Memorial Day weekend and was asleep when I got a call to get over to the Hoover Building right away. I looked at the alarm clock, squinting to focus, saw that it was 3:15 in the morning. Now what? Have there been reprisals? If so, they weren't telling me over the phone. I'll be right there, I said, pushing myself out of bed, cursing under my breath. I showered under hot, then cold water for a minute or two, toweled off, threw on clothes, and got in the car and drove through Washington in a horrible daze. All I knew was that the wolf was going to call in 30 minutes. 3:30 in the morning, after a long weekend, with the expired deadline hanging over our head. He wasn't just controlling. He was sadistic. When I arrived at the crisis room on 5, there were at least a dozen others already there. We greeted one another like old friends at somebody's wake. For the next couple of minutes, bleary-eyed agents kept filing into the conference room, nobody seeming completely awake. A ragged line formed at the coffee table as a couple of pots finally arrived. Everybody looked nervous and on edge. "No Danish?" said one of the other agents. "Aw, where's the love?" But nobody even smiled at his joke. Director Burns came in a few minutes past 3:30. He was wearing a dark suit and tie, formal for him, but especially at this time of the morning. I had the sense that he didn't have any idea what was happening either. The wolf was in charge, not any of us. "And you thought I was a tough boss," Director Burns cracked after a couple of minutes of silence in the room. Finally, there was a sprinkling of laughter. "Thank you for coming," Burns added. The wolf came on the line at 3:43. The filtered voice, the characteristic smugness and disdain.
"You're probably wondering why I scheduled a meeting in the middle of the night. Because I can. How do you like that? Because I can. In case you haven't been able to tell, I don't like you people very much. Not at all, actually. I have my reasons, good ones. I hate everything America stands for. So maybe this is partly about revenge. Maybe you've wronged me somewhere, sometime in the past. Maybe you've wronged my family. That's a part of the puzzle. Revenge is a sweet bonus for me. But let me get to the present. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I instructed you not to conduct any more investigations into my whereabouts. So, what do? You bust 6 poor bastards in downtown Manhattan because you suspect they're working with me. Why, one poor girl was so distraught that she went out a third floor window. I saw her fall. I suppose that you're thinking, such as it is, was that if you took out my operatives there, then New York City would be safe. Oh, I'm sorry. I almost forgot. There's also a little matter of a deadline you missed. Did you think I had forgotten about that? Well, I didn't forget about the deadline, or the insult in your missing it. Now, watch what I can do."
Chapter 56.
At 3:40 in the morning, following instructions, the Weasel took up a position on a bench in the Riverfront Park on Sutton Place and 57th Street. There was a great deal that bothered him about this job, but the problems were balanced by 2 large positives. He was being paid a lot of money, and he was in the middle of the action again. Jesus, am I ever in the middle of the shit? He stared down on the East River's dark, swift-moving currents. A red tugboat marked McAllister Brothers was assisting a container ship on its way. The city that never sleeps, right? Hell, the bars on 1st and 2nd Avenues were just getting down to their last call. A little earlier, he'd passed an animal medical center that was still open for late-night pet emergencies. Pet emergencies? Jesus. What a city, what a messed-up country America had become. A lot of New Yorkers would be wide awake soon, and they would find it exceedingly difficult to get back to sleep. There would be weeping and the gnashing of teeth. The wolf was going to make certain of that in a minute or so. Schaefer watched the seconds on his watch tick down to 3:43, but he was also keeping an eye on the river and the Queensborough Bridge. Cars and cabs and quite a few trucks were whizzing up along there, even at this hour. Easily 100 vehicles were crossing the bridge right now, probably more than that. The poor wankers. At 3:43, Schaefer pressed a button on his cell phone. This transmitted a simple coded squirt to a small antenna on the Manhattan side of the bridge. A circuit began to close, a primer fired. Microseconds later, a message straight from hell was delivered to the people of New York City and the rest of the world.
A symbolic message. Another wake-up call. A massive explosion ripped through the girders and trusses of the 59th Street Bridge. Joints were severed instantly, shockingly, terminally. The old steel structures snapped like peanut brittle. Huge rivets popped out and plummeted toward the East River. Tarmac crumbled. Reinforced concrete fractured like paper being shredded. The upper roadbed cracked in two. Then enormous sections dropped like bombs onto the lower deck, which was breaking up as well, peeling away, twisting and twirling toward the water below. Cars were falling into the water. A delivery truck carrying a full load of newspapers from a plant in Queens rolled backward down the inverted roadway and then pirouetted into the East River. It was followed by more cars and trucks, dropping like lead weights. Electric lines drooped and sparked along the entire length of the bridge. More cars, dozens of them, plummeted from the bridge, fell into the river, then disappeared beneath the surface. Some people were exiting their cars, then jumping to their death in the river. Schaefer could hear their terrifying screams all the way across the river. And in every apartment building, lights began to blink on. And TVs and computers, as the people of New York heard the first reports about a terrible disaster that was impossible to believe and that would have been unthinkable until a few years ago. His work for the night done, Jeffrey Schaefer finally rose from his park bench and went to get some sleep. If he could sleep. He understood this much. Things were just getting started. He was on his way to London. London Bridge, he thought. All the bridges of the world falling, crashing down. Modern society coming apart at the seams. The sodding wolf may be a madman, but he is a brilliant bugger at being bad. A bloody brilliant madman.
Part 3. Wolf Tracks. Chapter 57.
The wolf slowed his powerful Black Lotus to just over 100 miles an hour while he talked on his mobile phone, one of six he had with him in the car. He was headed toward Montauk, on the tip of Long Island, but he had important business to attend to on the way, even at 1 a.m. He had the American president, the German chancellor, and the British prime minister on the line. Top to top. What could beat that? This call can't be traced, so don't waste your time trying. My tech people are better than your people, he informed them. Now, what's on everybody's mind? We're 8 hours past the deadline, and?
We need more time,
the English Prime Minister spoke up for the group. Good for him. Was he the real leader of the three? That would be a surprise. The wolf had thought of him more as a follower.
You have no idea,
the American president started to say, but he was cut off by the wolf, smiling to himself, relishing the show of disrespect toward the powerful world leader.
Stop! I don't want to hear any more lies, he yelled into the phone.
You have to listen to what we have to say,
the German chancellor interjected.
Give us the opportunity.
The wolf ended the conversation then and there. He lit up a victory cigar, took a couple of satisfied puffs, then set the smoke down in the ashtray. He reconnected the call using a second cell phone. They were still there, waiting for him to call back. He didn't actually underestimate any of these powerful men, not really, but what choice did they have but to wait on his call?
Do you want me to attack all four cities? Is that what I have to do to prove how serious I am?
I'll do it in a flash. I'll do it now. Give the order right now.
But don't tell me you need more time. You don't. The countries holding the prisoners are your puppets, for Christ's sake.
The real problem is that you can't be seen for what you really are. You can't be viewed around the world as weak. and powerless, but you are. How did it happen? How did you allow it to happen? Who put people like you into these positions of great power? Who elected you? The money and the political prisoners. Goodbye. The Prime Minister spoke before the wolf could disconnect again.
You have it all wrong. It is you who have a choice to make, not us. We take your point about the strength of your position versus ours. It's a given. But we cannot put this package together quickly. It can't physically be done, and I think you know that. Of course, we don't want to make a deal with you, but we will. We have to. We just need more time to get it done. We will get it done. You have our promise on it.
The wolf shrugged. The English Prime Minister definitely surprised him. He was succinct. At least he had some balls. I'll think about it, said the wolf, then disconnected. He picked up his cigar and savored this idea. He was the most powerful person in the world right now, and unlike any of them, he was the right man for the job.
Chapter 58.
A business class passenger who called himself Randolph Wohler deplaned the British Airways flight from New York at 6:05 in the morning. His passport and other pieces of ID backed up his identity. It is good to be home again, thought Wohler, who was actually Geoffrey Schaefer, and it's going to be even better if I get to blow London off the map. The 70-ish-looking gentleman passed through customs without a problem. He was already thinking about his next move, a visit to his children. That was his peace. Curious and strange, but he was past questioning orders from the wolf. Besides, he wanted to see his progeny. Daddy had been away for far too long. He had a part to play, another mission, another piece of the puzzle. The Brat Pack lived with his deceased wife's sister in a small house near Hyde Park. He remembered the house as he pulled up in a rented Jaguar S-Type. He had a most unpleasant memory of his wife now, Lucy Riss Cousins, a brittle, small-minded woman. He'd murdered her in a Safeway in Chelsea right in front of the twins. That truly merciful act had orphaned his twin daughters, Tricia and Erica, who were 6 or 7 now, and Robert, who must be 15. Schaefer believed they were far better off without their whining, sniveling mother. He knocked on the front door of the house and found that it was unlocked, so he barged in unannounced. He discovered his wife's younger sister, Judy, playing with the twins on the living room floor, bent over a game of Monopoly, which he believed they were all capable of losing, not a winner in the group. "Daddy's home," he exclaimed, and beamed a smile that was perfectly horrible. He then pointed a Beretta at dear Aunt Judy's chest. "Don't make a sound, Judy, not a one. Don't give me the slightest excuse to pull this trigger. It would be so easy and such a great pleasure. And yes, I sincerely hate you too. You remind me of a fat version of your beloved sister. Hello, children. Say hello to your dear old dad. I've come a long ways to see you, all the way from America." His twin girls, his sweet daughters, started to cry, so Schaefer did the only thing he could think of to restore order. He pointed his gun straight at Judy's tear-stained face and walked closer to her. "Make them stop whining and screeching now. Show me you deserve to be their keeper." The aunt bent low and pressed the girls to her chest, and while they didn't actually stop crying, the sound was at least muffled and subdued. "Judy, now listen to me," Schaefer said as he moved behind her and pressed the barrel of the Beretta to the back of her head. "As much as I would like to, I'm not here to fuck and murder you. Actually, I have a message for you to be passed on to the Home Secretary. In a strange, ironic twist, your absurd, pitiful life actually matters for now. Can you believe it?
I can't. Aunt Judy seemed confused, her natural state as far as Schaefer could tell.
How would I do that? She blubbered.
Just call the sodding police. Now shut up and listen. You're to tell the police that I came to visit, and I told you that no one is safe anymore. Not the police, not their families. We can go to their houses, just like I came to your house today. Just to make sure she got it, Schaefer repeated the message twice more. Then he turned his attention back to Tricia and Erica, who interested him about as much as the ridiculous porcelain dolls covering the mantel in the room. He hated those silly, frilly porcelain doodads that had once belonged to his wife and that she had doted on as if they were real. "How is Robert?" he asked the twins, and received no reaction. "What is this?" The girls had already mastered the hopelessly lost and confused look of their mother and their blubbering auntie. They said not a word. "Robert is your brother," Schaefer yelled, and the girls started to sob loudly again. "How is he? How is my son? Tell me something about your brother. Has he grown 2 heads? Anything?"
"He's all right," Tricia finally simpered. "Yes, he's all right,"
Erica repeated, following her sister's lead.
"He's all right, is he? Well, that's all right then," Schaefer said with utter disdain for these 2 clones of their mother.
He found that he was actually missing Robert, though. He rather enjoyed the mildly twisted lad at times.
"All right, give your father a kiss," he finally demanded. "I am your father, you pitiful twits," he added for good measure, "in case you've forgotten."
The girls wouldn't kiss him, and he wasn't permitted to kill them, so Schaefer finally had to leave the dreadful house. On the way out, he swept the porcelain dolls off the mantel, sending them crashing to the floor.
"In memory of your mother,"
he called back over his shoulder.
Chapter 59. The most common complaint from soldiers serving in Iraq is that they feel that everything around them is absurd and makes no sense. More and more, this is the way of modern-day warfare. I felt it now myself. We were past the deadline and living on borrowed time. That's how it seemed to me. Feeling as if I hadn't been able to catch my breath in days, I was on my way to London with 2 agents from our international terrorism section. Jeffrey Schaefer was in England. Even more insane, he wanted us to know he was there. Someone did. The flight to Heathrow Airport arrived at a little before 6 in the morning, and I went straight to a hotel just off Victoria Street and slept until 10. After that short rest, I made my way to New Scotland Yard, just around the corner on Broadway. It was great to be so near Buckingham Palace, Westminster Abbey, and the Houses of Parliament. Upon arrival, I was taken to the office of Detective Superintendent Martin Lodge of the Met. Lodge told me, modestly enough, that he kept the anti-terrorist branch, called SO-13, running smoothly. On our way to the morning's briefing, he gave me a thumbnail sketch of himself. "Like you, I came up through the police ranks. 11 years with the Met after a stint with SIS in Europe. Before that, I trained at Hendon, then a constable on the beat. Chose the detective track and was moved into SO-13 because I have a few languages." He paused, and I spoke at the first break. "I know about your AT squad. The best in Europe, I've heard. Years of practice with the IRA. Lodge gave me a thin smile, a veteran trooper's smile. "Sometimes the best way to learn is through mistakes. We've made plenty in Ireland. Anyway, here we are, Alex. They're all waiting inside. They want to meet you very much. Get ready for some incredible bullshit, though. MI5 and MI6 will both be here. They fight over everything. Don't let it get to you. We managed to sort it all out in the end. Most of the time, anyway." I nodded. "Like the Bureau and the CIA back home. I'm sure I've seen it before." As it turned out, Detective Superintendent Lodge was right on about the turf wars. and I figured that the feud was probably hurting progress in London, even under the present crisis circumstances. Also in the room were a few special branch men and women. The Prime Minister's chief of staff, plus the usual crowd from London's emergency services. As I took a seat, I groaned inside. Another goddamn meeting. Just what I didn't need. We're past the deadline. They're blowing up things, I wanted to yell.
Chapter 60.
The large beach house outside Montauk on Long Island didn't belong to the Wolf. It was a rental, $40,000 a week, even in the off-season. A complete rip-off, the Wolf knew, but he didn't mind so much. Not today, anyway. It was quite an impressive place, though. Georgian style, three stories rising above the beach, immense swimming pool shielded from the wind by the house itself, pebble driveway lined with cars, mostly limousines, muscular drivers in dark suits congregating around them. Everything here, he thought with some bitterness, paid for with my money, my sweat, my ideas. They were waiting for him, several of his associates in the Red Mafia. They were gathered inside a library sitting room with panoramic views of the deserted beach and the Atlantic. They pretended to be his dearest, closest friends as he entered the room, shaking his hand, patting his broad back and shoulders, muttering easy lies about how good it was to see him. The very few who know what I look like, the inner circle, the ones I trust more than anyone else. Lunch had been served before he arrived, and then the entire household staff had been removed from the house. He had parked in back, then come in through the kitchen. No one had seen him except the men in this room, 9 of them. He stood before them and lit up a cigar. To victory. They have asked for an extension of the deadline. Can you believe it? The Wolf said between satisfying puffs. The Russian men around the table began to laugh. They shared the Wolf's disdain for the current governments and leaders around the world. Politicians were weak by nature, and the few strong ones who snuck into office somehow were soon weakened by the process of government. It had always been that way. Drop the hammer, one of the men shouted. The Wolf smiled. You know, I should. But they have a point. If we act now, we lose too. Let me get them on the line. They're expecting an answer. This is interesting, no? We negotiate with the United States, Britain, and Germany, as if we were a world power. The Wolf raised his index finger as the call went through. They're expecting to hear from me. You're all on the line? He spoke into the phone. They were. No small talk. The time for that has passed. Here is my decision. You have another 2 days, till 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. But the price has just doubled. He disconnected. Then he looked around at his people. What? You approve? Or what? Do you know how much money I just made for you? They all began to clap, then cheer. The Wolf stayed with them for the remainder of the afternoon. He endured their false compliments, their requests thinly disguised as suggestions. But then he had other business in New York City, so he left them to enjoy the house by the sea and whatever. The ladies will arrive soon, he promised. Models and beauty queens from New York. They say the most beautiful pussy in the world. Have fun. On my money, my sweat. My brilliance, he thought. He was back in the Lotus then, heading toward the Long Island Expressway. He was squeezing the black rubber ball, but finally he set it down. He took out his cell phone again, pressed a few numbers. A code was transmitted. A circuit closed. A primer fired. Even from that far away, he heard the beach house explode. He didn't need them anymore. He didn't need anyone. Zamoshit. The bombs had broken every bone in all of their worthless, useless bodies. Payback. Revenge. It was a beautiful thing.
Chapter 61. We received word in London that the deadline had been extended 48 hours, and the relief, though temporary, was still extraordinary for all of us. Within the hour, we got word of a bombing on Long Island. Several Red Mafia bosses reported dead. What did it mean? Had the Wolf struck again? At his own people? There was nothing useful for me to do after the long round of meetings at Scotland Yard. About 10 at night, I met with a friend from Interpol at a London restaurant, the Cinnamon Club, which was on the site of what had once been the old Westminster Library on Great Smith Street. I was past being exhausted, and in fact I had gotten my second wind. Besides, I always looked forward to spending time with Sandy Greenberg, who was probably the smartest police officer I had ever worked with. Maybe she had a new idea about the Wolf, or the Weasel. At any rate, no one knew the European